You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, and solar-powered radio broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Yes, and it's wintery, getting wintry in Iowa.
I guess it's that time of year. Time to head south for all the snowbirds, right?
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
So. Yep. We have some people in Texas, so we we could go live there, I suppose.
We could. But you know, I like a little bit of winter. I get tired of it about January.
Yeah. Right, gotcha.
So who do we have with us on Writers' Voices today, Mom?
Well, today we have Stephen Rosenfield, and he is the founding director of the American Comedy Institute. He coaches and directs stand-ups and actors ranging from beginners to Oscar-nominated talent and winners of MAC, Obie, Emmy, and Tony Awards. His stand-up students' accomplishments include performing in the top clubs in North America and around the world, creating and starring in their own sitcoms on HBO, Comedy Central, and TV Land. I mean, and this book is amazing. If you are interested in becoming a stand-up comic, you absolutely have to read this book. It is Mastering Stand-Up, The Complete Guide to Becoming a Successful Comedian, by Stephen Rosenfield. I highly recommend this. Not that I'm going to do this, of course.
That's the first thing Mom said to me when I asked her what she thought of the book. She goes, well, I don't think I'm going to be a comedian.
Well, there's a lot to it. There really
is. It is.
Really, but it's a talent. It's an in talent that's in your soul, I'm sure, you know.
Well, Stephen, welcome to Writers' Voices.
Thank you very much.
And tell us, do you really think someone can learn to be a comedian from a book?
Yes, of course. I know what the question is, but you know what I say? It's kind of, you know, behind that is the idea of, you know, can you teach somebody to be funny? But, you know, I like to think of immediately Einstein comes to mind. It's like, for me, it's like saying, can you teach someone to be Einstein? And no, of course you can't. But can you teach Einstein physics? Yes, you can, and you have to. And then if you've got an Einstein on your hands, you know, he or she will take the craft and into some wonderful place. So there's a lot of craft to this. There's more craft to it than I think people realize. And it's very, very common that people think when they see a comedian that this person just is getting up on stage and just spontaneously talking about stuff going on, and they're unbelievably funny. And that seems to be something that, you know, couldn't possibly be taught. And it seems almost magical, because it's like, how could someone just spontaneously be that funny? And the thing is, it is magical, which means it's a trick. and the trick is to learn how to perform the same material night after night in a way that seems fresh and spontaneous, just as actors do in the theater. And to learn how to write stand-up comedy material that appears to be spontaneous, that doesn't at all sound like it's written.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You talk about this in the book about how you like would go follow comedians from place to place and see how even things that seem like a pause or something that or a change or a I'm trying to remember the exact...
I remember it, actually. Yeah. It was very eye-opening for me. This was when one of the things I used to do when, you know, I was starting this would be I'd follow one comedian around to, you know, they'll do four shows a night at different clubs. And the first club I saw this guy, he did a few minutes, and then he said, oh, wait a minute, there's something else I wanted to tell you guys. What was it? Oh, right. Okay. And I thought, well, that's cool. He's really comfortable up there. He couldn't remember what he wanted to talk to us about, and it took a moment to do it. That's great. Then I went to the next club, and he did exactly the same thing in exactly the same place. And he did it four times. And I began to realize how written all of this really is. So it's not someone being spontaneously funny. It's a crafts person who has learned how to write and perform stand-up in such a way that the folks who view it feel like they're seeing and hearing something for the first time, when it could be material that's 2 years old, 4 years old, 8 years old. You know, wow. Jerry Seinfeld at the American Comedy Institute, we have a one-year program in for people who want to make a career of this, and it's in comedy writing and performing. And for our graduation show, he happened to show up, and he was looking for stage time. He was preparing for a performance he was doing in New York at the Beacon Theater. In chatting with him, it became apparent he was doing the very first set that he had ever done.
Oh my gosh.
And we're talking about the early 80s. And when he got up, it was fabulous. It was terrific. He's been working on that for ages.
Wait, you mean, okay, so what year was this that you were, that he came to this?
It was just this year.
Just this year.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was still doing material that he'd been doing since the 80s.
And he was doing stuff that you know, was about his growing up on Long Island and stuff that he probably wrote when he was in his 20s.
Wow.
And it was, of course, a big thrill for my students, because I was like, okay, everybody can put on their resume, you've opened for Jerry Seinfeld.
That's great. Now, are there, you know, there's a chapter in the book about ad-libbing and how some ad-libbing seems like ad-libbing and really isn't, but are there some comedians who really can ad-lib and be funny?
Yes, absolutely.
That's a talent, man.
And even though there's less of it than it seems to be, yes, there absolutely are moments. And you know, when you have a solid show, you know you're good at it, you can afford to take the chance of ad-libbing, because you know you've got terrific stuff on either side of it. But sure, of course there is. Not for everybody. You know, there's some people who just stay word for word on their set and they won't venture off of it. But there are other people who will genuinely ad-lib. When you see a major comic in a major venue, they're not going to be ad-libbing. In other words, you know, you got your HBO special. I think those things now cost about $4 million
to
produce. You know, it's like in a situation like that, I'm not backstage with the comedian going, what do you think you might talk about tonight? there's too much money at stake. You got to deliver up a great show.
Okay, what about Robin Williams? I always thought that his...
I was afraid you were going to ask me that question.
I always felt like he was just riffing. Was...
No, he wasn't. Lord. No, he wasn't. I mean, I suppose I say this with hesitation, but still, he was infamous for stealing material from other comedians.
Oh.
He wasn't... He was very, very rarely riffing. And there were comedians who, if they knew that he was in the club, they wouldn't want to go on. At the same time, he was brilliant. I don't want to take anything away from him. And taking other people's material is certainly frowned upon in this business, and it should be. But that's not to say that some people don't do it. But he was a terrific actor. He was an awesome actor. So a lot of what looked like it was being improvised was in fact not being improvised. And on top of that, he was a good improviser. In mm-hmm. addition to that, he was good at it. But he really is an example of somebody who looked like he was just improvising the entire thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. All right, another one. What about Andy Kaufman?
Andy Kaufman really, he really fascinates me. I'll tell you why. One of the things I tell my students, and something that's in the book, is that there's an objectivity to what we do, and that's a wonderful thing, because it's not available in other forms of writing and performing, which is our audience either laughs or they don't laugh. and you know it. You know, you could, you know, we know painters who, it's unbelievable, this $450 million sale of what may or may not have been Da Vinci. Van Gogh sold one painting in his life.
Whoa.
He sold it to his brother. He spent his life and died without any idea of the impact he would have on the world. Well, that's not true of comedians, okay?
Yeah.
Because there's no such thing as an undiscovered comedian, because they laugh. If you're doing it right, they laugh, no matter what you're doing. And Andy Kaufman is a great example of this, because his stuff... still, I mean, to this day, was so original and in many ways so edgy. And he was hilarious doing it. That great, I think it was the very first Saturday Night Live. And he was the only funny, they hadn't, you know, it was their first show, so they hadn't gotten their, you know, sort of gotten their sea legs yet. But he did that Mighty Mouse. He lip-synced the theme song to Mighty Mouse. and there's almost no lyrics. So he spent a lot of time just standing there. And the part that he sang was where he goes, "Here he comes to save the day." And it's a very kind of strong, macho, you know, super Mighty Mouse. And every time he got to that point, he would become that, you know, bold and strong performer. But in between that time, which was most of the time, he was a nervous wreck. It was clear that he was worried that he wouldn't come in on time. You know, he was clenching and unclenching his hands. You know, he had this look on. He had this. He was so concentrated, and then he'd come in, and suddenly it was Mighty Mouse, and then he would go back to this anxious guy, and it was an incredible piece of comedy because, first of all, it was hilarious.
Even just picturing it in my head, I'm laughing.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it's. I'm sure it's on YouTube. It's really great. And second of all, he did an amazing thing because he raised the stakes. And what I mean by that is that when you watch him, okay, in a comic way, you're not sure if he's going to make it or not. You know,
yeah, right.
No worries. You're thinking, well, Jesus, if he's this worried, maybe he's got something to worry about. So when he finishes the song, there's like this, it's a triumph. It's just this triumphant thing. He made it through. And how you can turn lip syncing into a triumphant comedy performance is mind-boggling.
That's brilliant.
Absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And he, you know, of course, you know, as we know, he had his problems and his issues, certainly. But when he was on target, he was as original, really almost kind of avant-garde in his originality, and absolutely hilarious and absolutely accessible. You didn't need anybody explaining it to you. It's just hilarious.
Well, Stephen, I don't know if you know, we're here in Fairfield, Iowa, which is the center of the Transcendental Meditation Movement in the United States. And Andy Kaufman was a part of the TM movement. He was a meditator, transcendental meditator. And in fact, I just saw an announcement, I think sometime this week, they're playing a tape of Andy and the Maharishi discussing comedy.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah.
God, I wish I could see that. Do you know where that tape
is? You know, I think it's on YouTube.
It is?
Yeah, I think so. I'll send you a link on that.
Okay, awesome.
All right, I will do that.
Now, there you mentioned in the book there are times when these comedians have to realize that they have to let a joke go because it just isn't going to play anymore, even though it has been successful for a long time.
Yes, that's right.
And that's probably hard to do.
Well, it is, but one of the reasons why a joke that's been successful stops being successful is a very, very good reason, which is this. I mentioned in the book, I think, I mentioned Einstein before. He has his theory of relativity. I have mine. and mine is that audiences laugh at, relatively speaking, the funniest material that they're hearing. And it could be, and this is like a really good thing, that you're writing... and performing, and your writing has so improved that what used to be the high point of your set is now no longer the high point of your set. You've gotten considerably better as a comedy writer.
Uh-huh.
And as a result of that, the audience is not responding to lesser material that used to be your best material. So it can be sad to say goodbye, but sometimes it's for... a really positive reason.
And then there are times when things that are in the news are no longer, you just can't make them funny anymore. And that.
Yeah, I know. I mentioned in the book there was one night at Caroline's, I remember, when it was, I think it was the first time that a good Monica Lewinsky joke didn't work. It was like a burial at sea. It was like, well. Made things pretty easy for us for quite a while, and I think the party's over.
Well, culture moves on, and that's part of it. It's part of the deal.
And the thing is that now it moves on at a ferocious rate.
Oh, yeah.
Sure,
I can't recall the sort of onslaught of huge stories, one after another after another. So it really does, and it's interesting because as a comedian, one of the things that I tell the comedians I work with is that when something tragic happens, you got to look at your set, because you may not think that you have anything in the set that relates to that, but maybe you do.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this really interesting example. I have a wonderful young comedian that I work with who is in high school, and he goes to Stuyvesant High School, which in New York City in the public school system is probably academically the top high school, and the fact that he goes there really helps his comedy persona, because he really is a serious geek. and he talks about Stuyvesant. And he has, in fact, his opening joke very often is, I go to Stuyvesant High School. Mm-hmm. It's an excellent school. It has the highest suicide rate in the state. I like a challenge. That's his opening joke. Well, that horrible day when that guy mowed down 8 people in New York City... Mm. He did it in front of Stuyvesant High School.
Oh my gosh!
And when actually we were in class and he got up and he did that, I said, this is a really good example. You gotta, at least for the next week, That name is going to be so associated with this that you can't, you really need to put that joke aside.
Yeah, wow.
You know, I just read something about the fact that, I don't know if it was all of the people, but a great many of them were from the same place.
I know, it's heartbreaking.
I believe
it was a South American country.
I'm not sure.
Saved up for years for this.
Yeah.
Oh, God,
yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Stephen Rosenfield, author of Mastering Stand-Up, The Complete Guide to Becoming a Successful Comedian. So, Stephen, are there people who are really good comedy writers who aren't necessarily good comedy performers?
Sure. And very often I would say they don't want to be.
Good thing, huh?
Well, no, not necessarily. I think there. It takes a certain mindset to be able to get up on that stage.
Oh, yeah.
And some people don't have that mindset, but they love, you know, writing comedy. I think I meant it in a slightly different way. I think for those people, they've chosen not to. I'll tell you here. Let me make this broader point. One of the things that's great about a career in comedy is that the usual divisions between crafts in the entertainment world really aren't there. If comedy is your field, and by that I mean, you know. A couple of years ago, Jennifer Lawrence won the Academy Award, or Meryl Streep usually wins, for Best Actress. No one would think of going and asking her for a script. It wouldn't cross their minds. But in stand-up and in comedy, when you start to get, you know, a buzz, when people start talking about you and you're starting to get a following, and agents and managers start getting interested in you, there's an immediate interest in your writing.
Mm.
A career in comedy, and if you think about the really successful, think about people like Tina Fey. You know, she's a writer. She's a writer on Saturday Night Live. She's a performer on Saturday Night Live. She becomes the head writer. Then she writes a movie that's done and it's successful, and then she writes another movie and she writes herself in with a leading role. So now she's some movie star, and she writes movies, and she's a television star on Saturday Night Live, and then she writes a television series, and she becomes an executive producer and a director and so on. And that's typical of a career in comedy. The people don't put you in that box unless you want to be. That's what I meant by that. That there's some people who would rather, you know, are very happy doing what they're doing, and that's fine. But that tends to be their choice more than any kind of judgment on what their capability might be potentially.
Well, no, people who have to do this stand-up thing every night, like, well, Jay Leno and so forth, they have writers, right? They don't write all their own stuff,
right? And it's kind of funny, you know, when I watch the Emmys sometimes with friends and neighbors who are not familiar with the business, and for instance, you know, Leno would win for Best Variety Show, and 22 writers would come walking out, you know, to accept the award. And they're like, who are all those people?
Yeah, right.
You know, they're the writers. You think you can do this? I mean, you know, these shows are incredibly good. They are mind-bogglingly good. And, you know, one of the things that I think it's great to do, and for folks who are interested in writing comedy, when they get to New York, if they come to New York, is go see one of those shows. They're a lot of them are in the city now. And when you're there and you're in the audience and you're watching it live and you're watching the show, it's just mind-boggling how good those shows are. And there's no way in the world that one person could possibly do that. It'd be impossible.
Mm-hmm. Now, most of that like any monologue on one of those shows or on the Daily Show, the Comedy Central shows, they, you know, they have their monologues and their skits. That material's just used once, right?
Yes, it's just used once. That's correct. Wow. The way it works is that the executive producer of the show meets with the host and maybe the head writer, but there's a meeting in the morning, and out of that meeting a decision is made of, here are the topics we want to cover tonight. We want to cover these three things tonight in the monologue, and then that's shot out to the writers who spend the day writing those jokes. And then those jokes come in. And when I say writing those jokes, for every joke that you hear a late-night guy say, there were 100 other jokes about that same subject that were not selected. They write a tremendous amount of material, and they pick the best.
Oh, gosh. Just going through all of that has got to be...
It's kind of amazing to me that no wonder you need a whole team to be able to come up with new jokes every day. And when I, you know, reading your book, and when you really give advice on how to take a joke concept and create a joke that really works from it by being more concise, shortening, being sure where you don't go on beyond the actual punchline, and you have really hands-on concrete advice in here. But it seems like that's something that it would take time even to refine a single joke.
Well, sometimes it does. Well, listen, let me say this. It does take time to refine a single joke. It does. I mean, that's the truth. Some people spend more time than others on it, but it does. Comedy is not written, okay? That comedy is never written. It is rewritten. It is written, and it's rewritten, and it's rewritten again, and it's rewritten again.
Okay, and sometimes a joke can ruin a comedian. Like, for instance, you refer to Michael Richards or Kramer. He did something.
Yeah, that wasn't a joke. It was after Seinfeld was over, and he was performing. I think he was at the Improv in L.A. It was in L.A.
Uh-huh.
He was heckled.
Oh.
It wasn't a joke. And in the book, I have a chapter on how to handle hecklers. Okay?
Right,
unfortunately, that book wasn't available when he... When he did what he did, because what you should do when you're heckled is you should have heckling material. A heckler can be a godsend, because anytime people think that you've just made something up on the spot and it's funny, that's guaranteed to get the biggest laugh. And if you have heckler material and you get heckled and you lean in with your material that gets the audience laughing at the heckler and sends a clear message for the heckler to shut up, you're the hero of the night. That's like the funniest thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But he had something happened, and it's a shame, because my God, what a gifted guy. But he tore into those people with a degree of racism that was terrifying, really terrifying. What came out of his mouth, the fact that such a thing could have been in his head, was really repugnant. And it pretty much just cost him his career.
Oh, golly.
And that's just, that was like a minute on a stand-up stage where he didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
It can also make a career, because there's another example, which is Chris Rock, and this is the power of stand-up in a positive way. He did the shows that could have made him and should have made him a major star. He did Saturday Night Live. Eddie Murphy was his mentor. And he did the other big sketch comedy show at the time, and it didn't happen for him. The Adam Sandler thing didn't happen. The Eddie Murphy thing didn't happen. And he resigned himself to doing stand-up, which he loved. I mean, you know, he had hoped that he would become a big star like Eddie Murphy. But he made peace with the thought that his career would be in stand-up. And he did a set in Miami. And I've timed this piece. It's 90 seconds long. And there was an executive from HBO who was in Miami and in that audience and heard this piece that he did, and was so blown away by it that he started the motions that event that very quickly got him his first starring role with his own show on HBO. So the exposure can be powerfully good, and with Kramer, it wasn't his material. It was unfortunately the awful things that were in his head.
What was it about Chris Rock's piece that stood out so much?
It was really edgy. It was genuinely edgy, which is not easy to do. It is not easy to do.
No.
Because we're very much, I mean, we're in an anything-goes time now. I mean, I'm thinking the scandal with Louis C.K., you know, he when he was on Saturday Night Live this season, he was doing pedophile jokes, you know, and if you can do pedophile jokes on network television, you know, you know, what's edgy?
Yeah,
if that's really mainstream, it's like, you know, what? He did something really edgy, and there's a word here that's a bad word, so I'm just going to indicate what the word is, okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
The piece is called I Hate, and then it's the N word, okay?
Oh, wow.
And in this piece, he was making the point that there are African-American people, black people who live their lives and raise their families and... And then there's a group which he called the N group, and he was saying they're ruining it for all the rest of us. That was really edgy as hell.
Yeah,
he was saying something that he really felt, which is important when you do edgy material. I want to get back to that in a second if I can, but it was something that he really felt. That in a way a huge group of people were being tarnished with reputations that they absolutely did not deserve.
Because of a
and
few.
That was the piece.
Yeah.
And I think that it's interesting because with really edgy comedy and Lenny Bruce, I would say the beginning of edgy comedy is probably Moms Mabley. And Lenny Bruce.
Wow.
They did stuff they really believed in. They weren't being edgy for the sake of being edgy. You know, they weren't being it to be sensational. They were doing it to be sensational. And because they really felt like there was a taboo out there that needed to be aired. By that I mean, you know, sunlight and fresh air put on it, something that we shouldn't talk about, like what Chris Rock did that night. Wow. That's not something you should talk about. But he did. That's what Lenny Bruce did. That's what the really great edgy comedians do.
Wow. You're listening.
Sometimes people think edgy is, you know, talking very graphically about sex. And it's not. I mean, it was a long time ago. I mean, you know, we can watch pornography on our phones. In 1929, Mae West, the great comedy writer, she was a fabulous writer and movie star, did a play on Broadway called Sex. And in this play, there was no cursing, there was no sex. but the play was called Sex, and there were prostitutes and people involved in, you know, in that kind of world. And the entire company was busted by the Vice Squad. They all ended up in jail. And that was really edgy in 1929. That was edgy.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not really all that edgy now.
I'd like to see that play now. I bet it's funny.
You know, there's a something that I would love to see. She did a movie script called Catherine Was Great, based on Catherine the Great.
Okay.
And I've just heard about the opening sequence, and here it is. So it's set in the, you know, the Tsarina's palace, and it's the morning, and the doors, giant, big, double oak, golden doors open up, and she, you know, she that famous walk of hers. She's walking down this corridor that's just lined with young soldiers. It's just, there's hundreds of them. And then the doors open to the throne room, and there's like maybe even 1,000 more new young soldiers who are in attendance. And she saunters up to the throne, and she turns around, and she makes eye contact with one soldier. And the opening line of the movie is, "You're new here, ain't you?" I wish I could read the rest of that script. What a phenomenal opening.
That's wonderful.
Wow.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Stephen Rosenfield, author of Mastering Stand-Up, The Complete Guide to Becoming a Successful Comedian. Stephen, how did you become a comedian?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, comedy, I think that for some people, comedy is almost like a language that they speak. And I have been speaking that language for as long as I can remember. And for a long time, it pretty much worked its way so that I would get into trouble for it. Because I couldn't help myself. It's like the thought of getting the laugh was too sweet. So I think I certainly had a predilection for this. And then my career in the beginning, in the very, very beginning, was as an actor and then as a director and as a writer. And in between shows, I would coach actors who would come, you know, into work with me in preparing for an audition or preparing for a role. And that was in the 80s when this gigantic boom happened in the stand-up world. And a stand-up came. He had seen a comedy show that I had, a sketch comedy show that I had written and directed, and got in touch with me and asked if I would work with him on his stand-up. And I said, sure. And when I started working with him, I realized that what we needed to work on, in addition to the performance, which when you're working with an actor is the only thing you need to work on, which is enough, God knows, is that the writing needed working on. And so I started writing with him, as well as coaching him on his performing. And I think maybe because my background was in the theater, I had a good ear for being able to, you know, write in a sense, write in somebody else's voice, not my own, but theirs. And we did really good stuff together. And he recommended more and more people come to do this. His name is Eli Krupnik, by the way. I want to mention it because he just passed away this year. He was the one who put together the first workshop that really became the American Comedy Institute, because they wanted me to be able to coach them individually, to work with them on the writing, and then have a class where they could perform in front of their colleagues. And they wanted me also to be at the club so that I actually saw it in performance. And I started doing more and more and more of it, and I loved it. So I really backed into it.
And did you ever do stand up yourself?
I did a little bit of it. I wouldn't say that I did. I mean, I would do a little bit of it myself on occasions, but I never made a career at all myself as a stand-up. And I think I fall under that category that I mentioned earlier of folks who would just who have chosen not to. One of the reasons why I stopped acting was I just got bored with essentially doing the same thing every night. I mean, it's a great challenge, and it just wasn't my thing. And it was the same, the thought of doing stand-up and doing the same thing and all the traveling was not the kind of lifestyle
that I wanted.
You cover something else what I found interesting about being a really good master of ceremonies, and that's very important. I didn't realize that.
Is it important?
A really
good master of ceremonies is really the glue that holds everything together.
Mm-hmm.
A terrific MC knows that the key to being an MC. I talk about this in the book. The most famous MC in history was Ed Sullivan,
right,
who had no
right,
act.
Right.
He just and
a really good
and
shoe.
He had trouble speaking. You know, I mentioned that. He's the one who famously said, "We have a really big show tonight." Except it sounded like he was saying, "We have a really big shoe tonight."
Right. Right.
But I learned something from him. Of course, I watched him when I was a kid, which was the key to being a really great, compelling MC is to have unbridled enthusiasm for the show. Because people feel the way, people feel the way that the person on stage is feeling, in the sense that if you have an MC who's really excited about the show, well, you're sitting there in the audience. You're getting excited about the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they also know how to bring performers on stage, which is really important. They know how to bring a performer on stage in a way that will get the audience excited about seeing them, the performer, and also gets the performer feeling really, really good about himself or herself. One of the things I tell the people that I work with is you never, as an MC, want to get a laugh at the expense of the person that you're introducing.
Oh, wow.
Never, ever. Part of your job is to get them feeling good about themselves when they're on their way up to that stage. Really good MC, if someone doesn't do all that well, won't just introduce the next person. They have material themselves. They'll get the bring that laughter back up, get the energy back up in the room before you bring on the next performer. And a really good MC will never bring up a performer when the audience is restless. If they're talking, a really gifted MC will shut that down before they bring on. So they're not the star of the show. They're never the star of the show, but they are absolutely essential to the show being a success. And a bad MC can take an evening of good comedy and not entirely trash it, but it comes awfully close to that.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of enthusiasm, the aimlessness, it can be deadly.
Right.
Now, Stephen, there's a theme that kind of goes throughout the book in various chapters about authenticity and how important that is. Do you want to talk? And you did allude to that a little bit earlier in our conversation,
yes,
too. But
the bottom line is they have to believe you. They have to believe you. Which doesn't mean that what you say has to be true. It means they have to believe you. If they don't believe you, you're wasting time, because they're jokes that I call jokey jokes, which are jokes where the audience knows what you're saying isn't true. And comedians sometimes will write jokes like that because they're funny. And they can be funny, but they don't really, those are not the kind of jokes that can really make a career, because I tell people who are writing and performing that, you know, here are the subjects of stand-up comedy. One, how you feel about your life, how you feel about your life in the past, present, future. Two, how you feel about all the other stuff. If you're interested in politics, how you feel about that, or if you're interested in culture, how you feel about that, whatever. End of list. There's two things on the list. So how can you be original if there are only two subjects? And the answer to that question is that the real subject is you. You're the subject. No matter what you're talking about, you are the subject. So, for instance, a few years ago, when late night still had Jon Stewart and Colbert with his own show, if you watch the late night shows, they talk about exactly the same thing, exactly. But Jon Stewart would handle it one way, and Stephen Colbert on the Colbert show would handle it another way, and Leno would handle it yet another way, and Letterman. The subject is you, and that's what they want to know about. And if you write jokey material, by that I mean inauthentic material, and by that I mean they don't believe it. They may laugh, because sometimes it's funny, and they may remember your joke, but they won't remember you, and that's what you want. You want them leaving the club, you know, talking about you, not talking about jokes.
Wow. Well, Stephen, would you like to read a little bit from the book so we get a feel for some of the advice and how you deal with it?
Okay, sure. I don't know how much you want, so just feel free to cut me off.
Okay.
It was the best of times. No, wait, I didn't write that. I'm sorry. Oh, my goodness.
No, this is from Mastering Stand-Up.
Oh, right, okay. That book.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought I'd read the first thing. I begin the book with the chapter that says, Things I Know About You. And I'll read this, and you can tell me when to stop. You have a lot of comedy inside you. I don't want you to ever doubt that fact again. There are only a few things I know absolutely. This is one of them. You may ask yourself, how the hell can he say that? He doesn't know me. He's not even here. Here's how I know. Would you have picked up this book if you didn't have a sense of humor? Put your palm out so I can read it. All your life, people have told you how funny you are. Sometimes you didn't even think you were being funny, but people laughed. If someone other than you was the class clown in school, you heard what that person put out there for laughs and thought to yourself, I'm funnier. You were right. And the people who've been telling you that you're funny, they're right too. So now, knowing you, you're probably thinking, okay, I'm funny with my friends and family, but that doesn't mean I could be funny on stage or write comedy professionally. You're wrong again. I'm sorry to keep contradicting you, but I feel I owe you the truth. You've been nice enough to pick up my book. There are tons of other books you could be reading right now, but you picked mine. So now we have a relationship. And when a relationship is founded on comedy, there has to be absolute candor. Why? Because the truth comes out quickly in comedy. It comes out the moment you get in front of an audience. Either they laugh or they don't. If I insincerely tell you that you're funny and you believe me and you got out in front of an audience and got no laughs, then you wouldn't believe me again. And that will be the end of our relationship. I have to be honest with you because I know the audience is going to be honest with you. Here's the truth. If you're funny with your friends and family, that's a sign you'll be funny on stage and that you can be both a writer and a performer of comedy. You have the talent. What you need now is the craft. Craft is what will transform your comedy from an entertainment for friends and family to an entertainment for a mass national audience. I can teach you the craft of performing and writing comedy. It's an exciting thought. You on stage at a comedy club getting big laughs. You submitting your comedy writing to a television show and hearing back about a staff writer position. It's exciting, but let's not uncork the champagne yet. You've got to get very, very good at stand-up for good things to happen. And I don't mean good once in a while when you have a terrific performance. I mean good night after night after night after night in small clubs and in big clubs, in your town and in towns and cities across the country, in front of packed audiences and sparse audiences, in front of people who know you and like you, and in front of complete strangers, in front of great audiences and dead audiences, opening a show and closing a show, following a comic who bombs and following a comic who kills. When you're pumped, when you feel like crap, when... You get the idea.
Okay, yeah. That's a good place to stop.
And I have something I wanted to ask him.
Yes.
You allude a couple times in the book to times when the audience was so loud, the fan mania was so terrible that the performer couldn't even perform. That's really sad to me.
Well, that was Steve Martin. That happens rarely. But when he did his stand-up, there was really kind of a Beatles mania that went on about him.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that was an uncommon, a very uncommon event. And he said that he might have continued if he thought of himself more as a kind of, orchestrator of a kind of party situation rather than a stand-up who had specific material. But that doesn't happen very often. Yeah. And listen, the heartbreaking part of that is he went on to become a huge, movie star.
Yeah, that is true.
I know.
That is true. Now, Stephen, what, after all these years of teaching people how to perform, helping with the writing, what made you decide to write a book about it?
Okay, that's a really good question. I think that all the other books are useful. I do. I've tried to read everything myself. But I didn't feel that a book had been written that went beyond being kind of a learner's manual. And I wanted to write a book about stand-up as an art form, as well as a form of entertainment, and as an art form and form of entertainment that really takes a lifetime to really master. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see that anyone had done that kind of book before. I wanted to write a book that would be useful to people who are just getting started, and a book that would be read avidly by people who are already headlining.
And how long did you spend writing this?
A year.
Wow, that's fast.
No, I did spend a long time writing it because I had spent, 27 years. I knew what the book was going to be before I wrote it. I always think Arthur Lorenz, the wonderful writer, film writer and musical theater writer, he said that, writing's not difficult. Knowing what to write is difficult.
Yeah, right.
I knew what I was going to write before I started, so it made my job a little easier.
That's a great quote. I love that one.
It is.
Wow. So when you decided to sit down and write this, did you work on it every day? Did it become sort of, did you have to put everything else aside to do this?
I couldn't put everything else. I was not in a position to do that because I'm also the director of the American Comedy Institute, and I have responsibilities there that it wasn't, I couldn't do that. But I had learned something, which is I try to be a reasonably good student of myself. and one of the things that I tell comedy writers is it's a business that you own. When you write comedy, you've just become a business owner, and you got to treat it like a business. Mm-hmm. And you got to schedule time to work, which is what I did. I worked out a schedule, and I stuck to it. I had a deadline, and that would have been the only way I could have done it. I think routine is very, very important to the creative process. It's how you become a pro, really. You know, I write comedy starting, you know, at 12:30 in the afternoon, and you know, I write it until 5:30 at night, and that's what I do. And the routine of that, I think, is enormously important, and it really gets your juices going. You're not waiting to be inspired or waiting to get into the zone. You're writing. This is what you do. You write.
And had you sold the book before you finished writing it, so you had an external deadline? Yeah.
Yes, I did sell it before. I wrote an extensive book proposal, which was far more demanding than I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. One of the things that interests me is how much the publishers want to know about your capacity to market the book yourself.
Yes.
It took more time than I thought it would. One of the things I needed to do with the kind of book that I had was to do a study of all the other books and what they were about and how mine was different from theirs. So there's a lot of work that goes into it. The proposal that's not your writing of your book. So based on the proposal, the book was Chicago Review Press bought it. And then I went ahead and finished it. I really started writing it seriously after it was purchased.
Okay. Well, that's a good way to do it because it gives you an external deadline that helps push it along. Now, this book is available, I'm assuming, wherever books are sold.
I know for sure it's available on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble,
and
the bookstores are carrying it, and if you're supporting your local bookstore, which would be awesome, and they don't have it, ask them to order it.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
we always recommend that. We love our local bookstores.
Right.
Absolutely. I feel the same way.
Yeah.
So, Stephen, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
It sure was. And, Mom, do you have some closing words of wisdom for us?
Well, this is a joke, I think. This Willie Nelson said this. Okay, I didn't know he was a comedian. But the early bird gets the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese.
Well, and my version of that is the early bird gets the worm and the early worm gets eaten.
True. My version of that is don't get up too early.
All right, stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday for Planet Erstwhile, and we have a rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. and see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.